You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Mein Kampf by Adolf Hitler.
Volume 2, The National Socialist Movement. Chapter 1, World Concept and Party. On the 24th of February 1920, the first great public mass demonstration of our young movement took place in the banquet hall of the Munich Hofbrauhaus, an extension of the famous beer maker Hofbrau Brewery. The 25 points of our program were presented to a crowd of almost 2,000, and every single point was received with enthusiasm. We finally had an opportunity to make the first principles clear and explained our plan for action that would lead our struggle to clear away the chaos of traditional views and ideas and the vague, even harmful aims that were ever present. The new force had appeared to split the corrupt and cowardly privileged class world, and this force would shatter the Marxists' wave of conquest. This new movement would ride the chariot of fate in front of the Marxists' march to triumph and halt it at the last moment before it reached its goal. It was obvious that the new movement's only hope to achieve the necessary significance and the required strength for the gigantic struggle ahead was, if it succeeded from the beginning in filling the hearts of its followers with the sacred conviction that we're not simply spouting a new election slogan into the political arena, but this new movement was placing a new world concept, one of great importance, in front of the people. Think about how pitiful the programs of these other so-called party platforms are. They are usually stuck together and shined up or reshaped from time to time, but one platform is basically the same as the next. To understand them, we must look at the motives which drive their construction. These motives, especially of the privileged class platform committees, must be put under the microscope so we can truly understand and judge how valuable these outrageous beliefs they call platforms are. There is only one reason which leads to the rewriting of party platforms or the modification of existing ones: the concern over who will win the next election. Whenever it begins to dawn on these parliamentary craftsmen that the good old common people are about to abandon the party and slip out of the harness of the old party bandwagon, the leaders repaint the bandwagon's wheels. Then come the so-called experienced and shrewd, usually old parliamentarians. These are the stargazers, the party astrologers, who can recall a similar crisis in their long political apprenticeship, when the people's patience ended and the mass defections loomed. They feel the same kind of calamity drawing dangerously near. So they resort to the standard formulas. Form a committee. Listen to what the good old common people are saying. Sniff at the newspapers and gradually smell out what the common people want, what they hate, and what they hope for. Every trade and every business group and every class of employee is carefully studied as its most secret wishes are examined. Even the empty catchwords, which are used by the now dangerous opposition, are suddenly re-examined. Frequently, to the surprise of those who first coined these phrases, they suddenly appear quite innocent, as if the ideas were taken for granted or obvious. Some of them are even found in the intellectual library of the old parties. So the committees meet, revise the old platform, and write a new one, in a way that gives everyone what he wants. This parliamentary class changes their convictions just as the soldier changes his shirt in the field. Whenever the old one wears out. No one is left out. The farmer's agriculture is protected. The industrialist product are protected. The consumer is guaranteed stable market prices. The teachers' salaries are raised and the civil servants' pensions are improved. The state is to take good care of widows and orphans. Commerce is promoted. Prices are to be lowered and taxes are to be practically abolished. Sometimes one group may have been forgotten, or a new demand among the people was not discovered by the party in time to add this revision. Any overlooked concessions are stuck on wherever there is space at the last moment. The patches are put in place until the party can faithfully hope that the army of middle-class Philistines and their wives are soothed and satisfied once again. Now armed with faith in the Lord and the unshakable stupidity of the voting citizens, the party can begin the struggle for reshaping the Reich, as it is called. When election day is over and the parliamentarians have held their last mass meetings for 5 years with no further need to consider the commoners, they focus on fulfillment of their higher and more pleasant duties. The committee that created this new platform disbands again, and the struggle for reshaping assumes the form of a battle for one's daily bread. Maybe this is why gatherings of parliamentarians are called diets.
The word diets has an alternate meaning, which is a formal legislative assembly.
The parliamentarians draw their daily pay by simply showing up, and the struggle degrades into a humdrum daily routine. Every morning, the honourable gentleman, the deputy of the parliament, goes to the house, and though he may not make it all the way in, he at least goes as far as the entryway, where the attendance lists are kept. He labours strenuously for the people by entering his name there and receives his well-deserved reward in the shape of a small payment for his long and exhausting efforts. After 4 years, just about the time their term of service is to expire, or during other critical periods, when the end of session of the parliamentary body draws nearer and nearer, these gentlemen suddenly feel an irresistible urge come over them, and they have a desire to take action. Just as the caterpillar cannot help turning into a butterfly, these parliamentary worms leave the home of their species and flutter out on newfound wings to the good old common people. Once more they speak to the voters, telling them about their own tremendous accomplishments and the stubbornness of their opponents. But sometimes they encounter rude and unfriendly expressions thrown at them from the stupid masses instead of grateful applause. If this lack of gratitude from the people rises beyond a certain level, there is only one thing that can save the day. The glory of the party must be shined up again, and surely the party platform needs more repairs. The party platform committee is set up, and the charade begins all over again. Considering the rock-solid stupidity of the public, we cannot be surprised at the resulting success of these tactics. Steered by its newspapers and blinded by the attractive new party program, the privileged class and the working class combine into a united voting herd as they go back into their old stalls and elect the same old deceivers. Then the man of the people and the candidate of the working class is transformed back into a parliamentary caterpillar, where he can continue gorging himself as he clasps to the branches of state life, where he will only be transformed into a glittering butterfly again 4 years later. There is nothing more depressing than watching the whole process in sober reality and seeing the never-ending fraud for oneself. The privileged class camp of politicians cannot draw enough spiritual strength from this kind of self-indulgent dealing to fight a battle with the organized power of Marxism. These upper-class people never seriously thought of battling them at all. With the admitted limitations and intellectual inferiority in these parliamentary snake oil salesmen who are supposed to represent the white race, how can they seriously expect to make any progress using Western democracy against a doctrine that, at best, is designed as a means to destroy democracy? Marxism is the means to an end, and that end is the destruction of Western democracy by paralyzing the political body, which in turn leaves the path open for itself. For now, one part of Marxism very shrewdly tries to pretend it is connected to the principles of democracy. But we must never forget that when the critical moment is upon us and Marxism is breathing down our necks, these privileged class legislators did not think a penny's worth of their time could be sacrificed to reach a majority decision on the protection of Western democratic principles. These privileged class parliamentarians believe the security of the Reich is guaranteed by the monumentally superior numbers on their side, so they remain blind whilst Marxism snatches power with a crowd of thugs, deserters, political evangelists, and Jewish amateur intellects. These legislators are giving the current democracy a resounding slap in the face through their failure to act. Only a legislator with the devout spirit of a witch doctor could possibly believe that the wicked determination of those who support and profit from this Marxist plague could be halted simply by uttering the magic spell of Western democracy. Marxism will march alongside democracy until it indirectly succeeds in gaining support for its criminal intentions from the very nationalist intellectual world which Marxism has marked for extermination. If Marxist leaders become convinced today that, somewhere in the witch's cauldron of our parliamentary democratic system, a numerical majority might suddenly be brewed which would furiously combat Marxism, the parliamentary hocus-pocus would be over in an instant. Instead of appealing to the democratic conscience, the flag bearers of the Red International Movement would send out a fiery call to action to the working class masses, and their battle would jump from the stuffy air of our parliamentary chambers to the factories and spill onto the streets. Democracy would immediately be over. What the intellectual prowess of these parliamentary apostles of the people had failed to accomplish in the parliament would now be accomplished by the crowbar and the sledgehammer wielded by the excited working-class masses, who would achieve the Marxist goals in a flash, just as in the fall of 1918. With one crushing blow, they would teach the privileged class world how crazy it was to think that one can resist the Jewish world conquest with the tools of Western democracy. As I have said before, it requires a trusting soul to honor the rules of the game when he is faced with an opponent who sees the rules only as a masquerade for his own benefit. And then the instant he no longer finds those rules give him advantage, he throws them overboard. In all political parties of privileged class orientation, the entire political struggle consists of a scramble for individual seats in Parliament. During this time, they adhere to convictions and principles until those principles begin to weigh them down, and then they are tossed overboard as easily as bags of sand. Naturally, their political platforms and programs are set up in a similar way, so they can be discarded just as quickly. The party's strength is measured by that scale, but in reverse. The more weight they discard, the more bogged down they become, and hence the weaker they become. They don't have that powerful magnetic attraction which the great masses want to follow, that aura of an irresistible impression, of great and outstanding principles, and of the convincing force of unconditional faith in those principles, along with a fanatical fighting courage to defend them. At a time when one side, armed with all the weapons of a world concept, even though it is absolutely criminal, prepares for the attack on an existing order, the other side can successfully resist only if it covers itself in the form of a new, and in our case, political, faith, and exchanges the catchwords of a weak and cowardly defense for the battle cry of a bold and brutal attack. If someone, especially one of the so-called nationalist privileged class ministers, like a Bavarian centrist, accuses our movement of working for an upheaval, there is just one possible answer to such a political Tom Thumb. Right you are. We are trying to make good what you, in your criminal stupidity, failed to do. You and your principles of parliamentary position jockeying helped to drag the nation into a black pit. But we will aggressively set up a new world concept, and with fanatical fervor, unshakably defend its principles. we will build the steps that our people will one day be able to again climb to the temple of freedom. When our movement was founded, we devoted our primary efforts towards preventing our army of fighters for a new and high conviction from turning into a mere society for the furthering of parliamentary interests. The first preventative measure was the creation of a program that urged the development of a party whose inner greatness was designed and calculated to frighten off the petty and weak minds of our present party politicians. The soundness and necessity of our idea to establish a sharp definition of our program's aims was best shown by those fatal problems which led to Germany's collapse. The recognition of the problems faced by Germany was bound to give a shape to the new state concept, which, in turn, is an essential element in a new world concept. In the first volume, I dealt with the word racialist, pointing out that this designation is too obscurely defined as an idea to allow it to form a solid fighting group. There are many groups that are as different as night and day floating around at this time under the blanket name racialist. So before I go on to explain the aims of the National Socialist German Workers' Party, I would like to clarify the idea racialist and its relation to the party movement. The word racialist is vague. It does not clearly express any specific idea, and it is subject to many interpretations, and it is as limitless in practical application as, for instance, the word religion. It is also difficult for us to create a clear picture in our mind about what it means, either for theoretical or practical descriptions. The term religious becomes concrete only when it is connected with a sharply defined form which is actually practiced. It sounds very pretty to say someone is deeply religious, but that is usually a hollow statement, for it says nothing about a man's character. There may be a very few individuals who feel themselves satisfied by such a general term, and others who may even assign to it a definite picture of a particular spiritual state. But the great masses are not made up of philosophers or saints. An absolutely general and non-specific religious idea like this will be turned into the listener's personal interpretation. It does not lead to an effective inner religious craving that one possesses when the purely abstract and unlimited world of ideas shapes itself into a clearly defined faith. This is not an end in itself, but only a means to the end. However, the means is the essential way of attaining the end. This end is by no means solely a theoretical ideal, but the bottom line is that it is extremely practical. In fact, we must realize that generally the highest ideals always correspond to a profound vital necessity in our lives, just as the nobility we see in beauty is ultimately determined by a form that is logical and useful in the end. The beauty of form follows its function. Faith helps to raise man above the level of a mere animal existence, and it contributes to strengthening and safeguarding his existence. His religious training includes religious doctrine, but in practicality also includes morals, ethics, and the principles it supports. If you eliminate this religious training, it will result in a critical weakening of the foundations of his existence. It is safe to say that man lives to serve higher ideals, but these higher ideals also are the essentials for his existence as a man. The circle is complete. Even the general term religious implies certain basic ideas or convictions. Some of these are the immortality of the soul, the belief in eternal life, and the existence of a higher being. These ideas, though firmly believed as factual by the individual, are still subject to the interpretation of that individual, and subject to his acceptance or rejection of them if the emotional power behind them does not take on the force of an undeniable law that is the doctrine that defines a clear faith. More than anything else, this doctrine is the fighting element which breaks through the outer appearance of fundamental religious views and pushes those superficial, theoretical trappings aside to clear the path for a deep and committed faith. Without a clearly defined faith, the multiple vague forms of religious feeling followed by individuals would not only be worthless for human life, but probably would contribute to general disintegration. The same analysis for religion is true for the term racialist. It too embodies certain basic ideas, but these, even though of outstanding importance, are so vague in form that they have no value beyond an opinion more or less deserving of recognition. The ideals of a world concept and the requirements deduced from them are not understood by pure feeling or men's inner will any more than freedom is conquered by a universal desire for it. No, only when the idealistic longing for independence is organized to fight in the form of military force can the compelling desire of a people be transformed into a splendid reality. Even a world concept that is totally sound and of the utmost value for humanity will never have a practical value and will never shape the people's lives until its principles have become the banner of a fighting movement. The movement will remain a party until its work has been completed by bringing its ideas victory and its party doctrines form the new state whose principles shape the community. If an abstract intellectual concept is to serve as the foundation for future development, the first requirement is to create a clear understanding of the nature, the character, and the extent of this idea. This is the only way a movement can be founded so that it maintains the inner cohesion and uniformity of its convictions, and from this uniformity it will develop the necessary strength for the battle. General concepts must be molded into a political program, a general world concept into a definite political faith. Since its aim must be one that is within reach and can be accomplished in the real world, this faith must not only serve the idea, but must include the means that will be used to fight and to win victory for the idea. Along with the theoretically sound intellectual idea which was originally declared by the program maker, the politician must also use his practical insight to shape the idea into an achievable plan. An eternal idea that is the guiding star of humanity must adjust itself so that it takes into account the weaknesses inherent in man, because of general human imperfection, and only then can it avoid failure the instant it begins. The founder of the idea, the explorer of truth, must be joined by the man who knows the people's spirit, and they must work together in order to extract what is humanly possible for tiny mortals from the realms of ideals and eternal truth, and to give it a shape that can be used in the fight. The transformation of a general and idealistic world concept into a definite, tightly organized, political fighting brotherhood of faith, which is unified in both mind and will, is the most significant achievement we can hope for. Any chance of victory for the idea depends completely on this successful transformation of an idea into a practical plan. Out of a crowd of millions who individually have at least some understanding of these truths, and a few who may fully understand them, one man must arise who can form clear and rock-solid principles. This man will create a force out of the shifting tide of understanding that exists in the broad masses. And this force will be so strong it cannot be doubted. He must fight to make the truth of these ideas exclusive, so that no others can be considered, and continue in his fight until he creates an unshakable rock out of man's will, and a single solid belief rises from a world of free-flowing and shaky ideas. The right to take such action comes from necessity, and the right of the particular man to take this action is justified by his success. When we try to find the inner core meaning of the word racialist, we come to the following conclusion. The ordinary concept that exists in politics is that the state in itself has creative and cultural energy it can use to build a civilization, but has no understanding of the essentials of race in the creation of a state. The state is thought to be more of a product of economic necessities, or at best, the natural result of a political lust for power. if we extend this view to its logical conclusion, it leads to a misconception of racial forces, and it leads to the idea that the individual is of little importance. If we deny that the different races vary in respect to their general powers of creativeness in their own culture, then this must mean that when we evaluate the individual person, he too does not vary in his powers of creativity. The assumption that the races are alike leads to a similar attitude toward peoples, and thereby toward individual men. Consequently, international Marxism itself is just the transformation by the Jew Karl Marx of a long-existing world concept into a definite political profession of faith. Without the widespread pre-existing foundation of such a poison, the amazing political success of this doctrine would never have been possible. Among millions of people, Karl Marx was the one man who, with the sure eye of the prophet, recognized the poisons essential to his plan were already in the swamp of a slowly decaying world. He separated and identified those poisons like a black magic wizard to make a concentrated solution he could use to speed the destruction of the free nations on this earth. All this was done to serve his race. Marxist doctrine is the extract of the intellectual soul of today's universal world concept that is boiled down into a concentrated form. For that reason alone, any struggle against it by our privileged class is impossible, and I would even say such a fight would be ridiculous. The privileged class world is already saturated with all these Marxist poisons. It has already declared its devotion to a similar world concept which differs from the Marxist concept only in its degree and in the character of the privileged class people who hold those beliefs. The privileged class world is Marxist, but they believe they can somehow dominate and keep the privileged class in control. However, true Marxism works day and night to deliver the world into the hands of the Jew. The racialist world concept, on the other hand, recognizes the importance of the racial component of humanity. In principle, it sees the state only as a means to an end, and its end is the preservation of the racial existence of mankind. In other words, racialist theories are far from believing all races are equal, but understand different races have inferior or superior merit along with their differences. This understanding obligates racialism to honor the universal will of nature that rules the universe and assists in the victory of the better and stronger, and to demand the subjugation of the inferior and those weaker. In principle, it acknowledges the aristocratic idea of nature and believes in this law's authority down to the last individual creature. Racialism recognizes that races have different values, and there are different values of individual men. Out of the masses, we see the significance of the individual emerge, and this effect results in the organizing force of racialism, and not the disorganizing force of Marxism. It believes the ideal of humanity is a necessity, since it regards the achievement of this ideal as the sole essential element for the existence of mankind. However, it cannot allow an ethical idea to prevail if that idea represents a threat to the racial life of those who maintain a higher ethical ideal. In a world that has become bastardized and negroid, any concept of what is beautiful in humanity and noble, and any image of an idealized future for our part of humanity, would be lost forever. Human culture and civilization on this planet are inseparable from the existence of the Aryan. His extinction or downfall would bring the barbaric, uncivilized ages on the globe once more. In the eyes of any race-based world concept, undermining of the existence of human culture by destroying the one group that sustains it is the most repulsive crime possible. He who dares to harm the highest likeness of the Lord on this earth offends God, the creator of this miracle, and is the cause of our expulsion from this paradise. Therefore, the race-based world concept agrees with the profound will of nature. It restores that free play of natural forces which lead, stage by stage, level by level, to a continuous improvement of the race by natural selection, until the best of humanity acquires its rightful possession of this earth, and finally wins a free hand to rule, which will extend throughout the world, and even beyond this world. We all have a feeling that in the distant future, man may be faced with problems that are so big, only an outstanding race and a powerful ruling nation which is supported by the entire world will be capable of solving. It is obvious that attempting to impose such a general definition on the extensive meaning of a race-based world concept may lead to 1,000 different interpretations. In fact, there is hardly even one of our newer political organizations that does not in some way fall back on this concept of the world. The very existence of racialism, as opposed to the multitude of other variations, proves there is a difference in their concepts. The Marxist world concept, which is led by a unified head organization, faces a jumble of opposing views which makes little impression on the enemy's united front. Victory cannot be achieved by such weak weapons. Only when the international world concept that is politically led by organized Marxism is opposed by a race-based concept that is equally unified and equally organized and equally well led, will these two camps meet on even ground. And that is when victory will stand with the camp that has eternal truth on its side. However, this is only possible if both sides possess equal fighting energy from their members. The organized embodiment of a world concept can exist only if there is a precisely defined formula that lays it out. What doctrines are for religious faith, the party principles are for the political party. Therefore, a tool must be made for the race-based world concept, just as the Marxist party organization clears the road for internationalism. The racialist movement needs a party organization that will allow it to take its rightful place in battle. This is the aim of the National Socialist German Workers' Party. The party's ability to embrace and integrate the racialist idea into its own organization is indispensable for the victory of the race-based world concept. The best proof is a fact that it is admitted, at least indirectly, by those who oppose the integration of race-based ideas with party principles into a party unit. The very people who never become tired of insisting that the race-based world concept is not the hereditary property of an individual party and cannot be claimed by a single party because it sleeps or lives in the hearts of millions of people, are proving themselves wrong. Because the fact that this idea exists in millions has not stopped the approaching victory of the opposing world concept of Marxism. If this concept did exist in a clear way in their hearts, the German people today would have already won a tremendous victory, and they would not be standing on the brink of an abyss. What brought success to the internationalist world concept of Marxism was the fact that it was maintained by a political party organized as an offensive militant stormtroop. What defeated the opposing world concept was a lack of the uniform and united support needed to fight for their cause. A world concept doctrine cannot fight and win if it allows the unlimited freedom for anyone to interpret its meaning. It can only fight and win if it is clearly defined in the limited and consolidated form of a political organization. For this reason, I took it upon myself to sort out the extensive and unformed substance of a general world concept, and to remodel those central ideas into a rigid dogmatic form. These clearly defined doctrines are capable of unifying the people who pledge themselves to these principles. In other words, the National Socialist German Workers' Party adopts the essential elements from the race-based world concept. These principles form a political declaration of faith by taking into consideration practical realities and limitations, the times we live in, and the available human resources as well as their weaknesses. This creates a closely knit organization consisting of the greatest masses of people possible, and it provides the basis for a fight to victory on behalf of this world concept. ¶¶
tuned in to Radio Aryan.